Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Welcome, everybody. It's Karen Conti here tonight. We have got a really great show tonight. It's varied and it's interesting. We are going to be talking to a cardiologist with Northwestern Memorial Hospital, and we're talking about heart attacks. We're talking about what you should do to keep your heart healthy. And it's a very interesting topic. We're talking about strokes. We're talking about all kinds of things. As you may know, my husband, Jerry, had open heart surgery about 3 weeks ago, which was a really interesting process, a really difficult and arduous process. And he's still recovering. And Dr. Mendelsohn is going to be talking about what you can do to improve your heart health. I think everybody needs to hear it and needs to envelop good heart health. And then we have Jason Van Dyke's attorney, criminal defense attorney, Dan Herbert, who's coming on around 7:45. And Van Dyke was convicted on October 5th of second degree murder in the shooting of Laquan McDonald. A little bit of time has gone by now, and it was a huge media rush. But we're going to be talking a little bit about the verdict, what comes next, what Mr. Van Dyke is doing now, what the appeals might be, and what the issues might be on an ongoing basis with the police department. Dan Herbert is a former police officer himself. He went to night school and became a lawyer. Prosecuted for a while, and now he represents police officers mostly in civil and criminal matters. So that is going to be very interesting. And I'm going to ask if anyone has any questions about the Van Dyke trial or about what happened throughout that trial. I think it was very, very well watched, and it was very dramatic and probably one of the most watched Chicago trials ever. And that is largely because we now have cameras in the courtroom and we were able to watch much of the proceedings. Very, very interesting case. So you can call in and ask questions. Mr. Herbert is, I'm sure, willing to answer those questions. And then a little bit after 8, we'll be taking your legal questions as usual. As you know, I'm a practicing lawyer. I've been practicing for 32 years, and I have learned a little bit in that period of time. So I know enough to probably give you an answer or two and or direct you in to the right place. So the numbers here, you can put those into your phone, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200, or you can text to that very same number. You know, I always love to look up the national days. You know, there's always a day like national, what's today? Today is, Ben is looking at me like, what is she going to say? National Dessert Day. Today is National Dessert Day. So here's my question. Here's my question to you, Ben, and here's my question to you, Roger, over there in the newsroom, probably chomping on a piece of apple pie. How often do you eat dessert? How often do you eat dessert? And when you do, what's your favorite?
I don't.
This is Ben.
Yeah, I don't nearly as often as I used to, but my go-to is definitely either a peach cobbler or Bananas Ooh. Foster. One of those two.
Peach cobbler. Okay, when you do the peach cobbler, is it hot?
Oh, yeah. Has to be.
And is it with the ice cream or with whipped cream?
Ice cream.
Ice cream. Do you know who has a great peach cobbler? R.L.
Really?
R.L., yeah. It's just fabulous. I think they only have it in the summertime because it's fresh peaches and it's just out of this world. And what was the second one you said?
Bananas Foster.
Bananas Foster. Now, Bananas Foster, they say, was originated in New Orleans at, what's the place? Commander's Palace. They claim that it was originated there. Now, do we know that that's true?
I don't.
No, don't know.
But I've seen a lot of food specials, you know, on TV go there and they keep claiming it.
Yeah, it's a big production there. They light it on fire and they take out special arson insurance and all that stuff. Okay, Roger, you're awful quiet, which makes me believe you're eating something. Roger, what do you think? What's your favorite dessert? Oh, Roger's not listening. You know, I have to say, I don't eat dessert very often, but when I do, it's never anything. It's just all the way, you know? It's all or nothing. I would say pecan pie is probably my favorite. Roger's there?
Yeah. Hi. Roger. I'm sorry. I was having dinner, and because you're supposed to have dinner before dessert, aren't you?
Well.
Unless your dessert is your dinner.
I knew you were eating. Okay. So I was saying, I don't. I probably have dessert, Jerry. What do you think? Twice a month? Maybe twice a month. I'm not a dessert person. Well, I am a dessert person, but you know that would mean much more exercise. Roger, how often do you eat dessert?
I really don't, but then again, my diet is not really conducive to desserts. I just
Because if you don't stop eating, it's hard to eat dessert. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. It's dessert. It's just a name. It's in name only. In other words, I consider dessert to be regular food.
Okay. So what is your favorite dessert? You have about an hour left on this planet, and you're going to have dessert, and what is it going to be?
Oh, wow. Chocolate chip mint ice cream with chocolate cream pie, triple chocolate cake.
I see a theme here.
Yeah, I like chocolate.
Okay, and so our next guest, who is a cardiologist, is going to answer my question, which is chocolate really good for you? They say it's good for your heart. I'm not sure. But stay tuned, because we're gonna find out the answer to that.
I keep living on the fact that dark chocolate is good for your heart.
Yes.
Anytime I want chocolate, I'm going to make it dark chocolate.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Make Sundays your official night to tour the city. Watch Chicago's Best at 10 p.m. Then stick around for the latest in shopping, entertainment, and events on See Chicago at 10:30 p.m. on WGN-TV. Well, we all have concerns about our heart and the health of our heart, and this issue has come to be very present in my life lately, and I want to introduce my guest, who's going to be talking about heart health. Dr. Marla Mendelson is a cardiologist, and among other things, she is the director for women's cardiovascular health at Northwestern Memorial Hospital and an associate professor of medicine and pediatrics at the Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to see you. Now, there is an issue with gender bias in the issue of medicine in general. And tell me why there's a difference between how men are treated by physicians and how women are treated by physicians in your area.
Well, not to get too technical, but there's two different things. There's sex bias, which is sex differences, which is biologic. And then there's gender bias, and that's more social and societal. So what's happened, I can speak toward cardiovascular disease in women, particularly heart attacks in women, because we have a lot of data on that. And what happened about 20 years ago was that women would come in with chest pain, and they went out with Tums, and men would come in with chest pain, and they'd go to the cath lab, and they'd have operations and angioplasty. And the statistics were appalling, because the men, after a heart attack, were doing so much better than the women, because the medical community and women themselves were not recognizing that they could be at risk for a heart attack. So that was back in, it was 1991, I think it was, when we first got those studies. And so since that time, we've been trying to educate women and their doctors that they are at risk for heart disease. And it's some of the same risk factors for men and for women. Heart disease in women classically may occur more often after the menopause, but we can't ignore it. And we were seeing a lot of younger women presenting with heart attacks.
I hear that, you know, just friends of friends. You hear women having heart attacks and strokes at a much, much younger age than you would imagine. So tell me, let's talk about the classic signs of a heart attack in a man, and how are those, are they different in a woman?
Well, in a man, you've seen this on television, they grab their chest, they fall over, and everybody assumes they're having a heart attack.
Right.
And it could be something else, but that's what the assumption is. And if a man has a pain between his jaw and his belly button, his wife will classically take him to the hospital because he's having a heart attack. Women get chest pain. It's whether they recognize it or not. Now, the other signs of a heart attack that can be less dramatic are, jaw pain, left arm pain, indigestion. And it's a matter of framing this into the context of when it happens. If you run up a flight of stairs and you have chest pressure, that could certainly be your heart. If you just ate something you weren't supposed to eat and you're up all night, maybe not your heart. So you have to put it in perspective. Women may have less classic symptoms, but when they look at studies the other way around of people who've actually had a heart attack, women will have chest pain and they will have signs of heart disease even before the actual heart attack happens.
And why is it, though, that women don't recognize it? Because I guess I think of women as being much more attuned to their bodies in some ways, and they're more sensitive to their, you know, their changes and things like that, whereas sometimes men seem a little blockheaded when it comes to their physical things. Maybe that's just my prejudice.
This has been going on, that women don't recognize that this is that they are susceptible to heart disease. That's the main
That's
problem.
The key, I guess.
You have to, if you think you're at risk for heart disease, you're going to go into the emergency room when you have chest pain. If you think it's a guy's disease or it's a disease I'll have when I'm 80, then you're less likely to show up. And we've proven through multiple studies, and especially in the setting of a heart attack, time is of the essence. We want to get in there. We want to open up the artery. We want to save heart muscle. And then there's a whole plethora of heart problems that certainly men and women are susceptible to that aren't necessarily heart attacks.
Okay. Let's just talk generally. And you do a lot of interesting work with heart, congenital heart defects and women in pregnancy and heart attacks and things like that. But I want to talk just generally about heart health. And, you know, there are some things I suppose you can control in your life, and there's some things you can't control. What are the things regarding your heart that are key in whether or not you have a healthy heart?
Well, it's very important. You talked about the ones you can control and the ones you can't control. You can't control who your parents are.
Right.
And there is a large genetic component, especially if either parent had a heart attack before age 50 or 40 for men. So that you can't control. But knowing that, the other ones you can control. Diabetes can be controlled, and if people have diabetes, certainly meticulous control of their diabetes helps as far as their cardiac output. Diabetes, people who have diabetes have heart disease, and we may not even know it because they don't get classic symptoms. The disease can be there for a long time, whether it's a young woman or a young man. It's certainly a very potent risk factor. Hypertension.
Yeah.
That, again, can be maybe genetically determined, but there are things people can do to prevent that. Smoking is
right
ultimately preventable. It's a hard thing to do to quit, and we acknowledge that, but it's a very potent risk factor, and it's very important to not start. But if you are smoking, to stop. And cholesterol. And cholesterol, there may be a genetic component to that as well. But certainly, as previously discussed, there's a huge dietary component that people can have control over. Now, for women, there may be a few more risk factors, like obesity, particularly central obesity, which has been classically described more in men. But central obesity in women may be a risk factor.
And when you say central?
Stomach area rather than the hips.
Okay.
You know, it's the whole apples and oranges.
Yes.
So if a woman is looking more like an apple with her central obesity, she may have increased risk of cardiovascular disease.
Let me just interject a question there. Is that because the fat on that and the pressure on your chest and that stomach area is more damaging, or is it just the nature of how someone gains weight has to do with something about their health, their
heart?
It
probably has more to do with the weight gain and the metabolic consequences of it. So people who have fat around there, they tend to have more diabetes or pre-diabetes, more hypertension. So it really all goes together.
Okay.
That whole syndrome goes together. It's not more of a physical thing. I hate to tell you, everybody's heart has some fat on it, but that's not what gets inside the arteries necessarily. And then the other thing in women is sedentary lifestyle, which I thought was all cured after Title IX came in, but apparently not. So a sedentary lifestyle for women and when they went through menopause. So if a woman goes through menopause early, before age 50, the clock starts ticking a little sooner for the risk of heart disease.
Interesting. And I want to talk, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about hypertension. I had a friend who was as healthy as can be. He rides his bike 100 miles on a weekend, eats fairly healthy, and it turned out he had super, super high hypertension and didn't know it, and either ignored the symptoms or didn't know the symptoms. So I want to talk a little bit about that very important issue with Dr. Marla Mendelson. Do I take a break now, Ben? Yep. Okay, let's take a break. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Don't tell my heart, my heck-breaking heart. I just don't think you'd understand. And if you tell my heart, my heck-breaking heart, he might blow up.
Dr. Marla Mendelson is here talking about achy breaky hearts. She is a cardiologist at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. We are talking about hypertension. We're talking about high blood pressure. Do people who have high blood pressure and don't know it, will they have symptoms always or are sometimes asymptomatic?
Hypertension has been dubbed the silent killer for that reason. And sometimes you don't know you have it until it's done damage to the blood vessels of the head, like a stroke, or kidney blood vessels and cause kidney disease and kidney failure or heart attack. People don't know it. And that's the trouble. Now, there are people who get signs early on, and that's why it's important to check in periodically with your doctor to see about your blood pressure. Like, for example, a woman who has high blood pressure during pregnancy, there's a good chance she's going to have high blood pressure later in life, and she needs to keep an eye on that. So
that can permanently elevate a woman's blood pressure?
Or maybe a sign. It may be a sign of future problems. And it may not be a problem for 20 years, but then she may have problems. And so that's the problem with hypertension. And it's also the problem from a clinician's point of view as far as treating it. Because somebody walks in, their blood pressure is high, and, oh my God, I have to give you some medication. And they go, well, I don't feel bad. And of course you don't feel bad, but you really need to break the cycle. Now, there's things in the American diet like salt that may contribute, lack of exercise, but that's not necessarily the case. Some people just have hypertension. They may have some underlying kidney disease that we need to find out about.
Should someone go out and get one of those things that you get at Walgreens that tests your blood pressure? Is that a good investment?
You could get it at Walgreens. You could get it at the health club. You could have it checked at church. There's a church-based program that the Heart Association did. Anywhere you get your blood pressure checked, it's important.
Okay. And let's go to that dietary situation. Now, I'm going to talk because this is like coming from me. I'm a pretty healthy person. I exercise a lot and all of that, but I love my salt. I love my salt. Is salt ever okay? I mean, like, I'm talking about more than your normal amount. I mean, there's salt in all foods, really a lot of salt. But the added salt, is that always bad?
It's bad if you have hypertension.
Okay.
It won't give you hypertension, but it's bad if you have hypertension because not only does it perpetuate the hypertension, but it interferes with the medications. So we tell people who have hypertension, and there's good data to support this. There's something called the DASH, D-A-S-H, trial, where they took two groups of people. One group they gave medicines to and said, bye. The other group they said, you eat fish, chicken, fruits, and vegetables. You walk every day and don't put any salt on your food or don't have any added salt in your diet. That group also lowered their blood pressure.
Okay.
So there's something to it.
So, what it says in medication, salt, and the rest does not help. And medication. Okay. Someone said, I've been heavy and I've been thin. This is a texter from 630. I've been active and I've been non-active, yet nothing changes. I have hypertension. It's the same no matter what I do or eat. My parents live to be 196 with no heart problems. It's frustrating. It makes me want to give up. And medicine, salt, and the rest does not help. Does that sound common?
Well, I think you have to do sort of a deep dive into the diet to make sure there's no hidden sources of salt. Like, I tell people what has salt in it, and I see their faces just drop. It's pickles. It's olives. It's capers. It's Chinese food and Japanese food because of the soy sauce. It's lean cuisine and healthy choice has a lot of sodium. A lot of prepared food has sodium in it.
Because it tastes good. It makes it taste good.
It's a cheap seasoning.
Yes.
You know, if you want to sprinkle something, sprinkle oregano, garlic, onion, but nothing with the word salt in it. And so people like that have to do a really close look. I had somebody once whose blood pressure was impossible to treat, and we went over the whole thing, the diet, and I said, no pickles, right? And he said, I don't eat the pickles. And I said, what do you mean you don't eat the pickles? He goes, oh, I drink the juice.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's,
you don't need to be a cardiologist to say no to that one.
There may be something there that we have to, that is an explanation for it. It is better to be thinner than overweight for the rest of your health, besides the hypertension. But, and then there can be a problem, with the artery to the kidney, which is important to diagnose, especially in a young person with hypertension. There could be a blockage in the artery going to the kidney, and that's something that's eminently treatable. And it, but you have to do the studies to find out.
Texter from the 312 says, my mother died at 45 years old, but she had rheumatic fever when she was 12. Should I be worried and proactive?
Well, rheumatic fever is...
What is rheumatic fever?
Rheumatic fever is caused by a strep infection, and it can result in rheumatic heart disease. Now, fortunately, this is rare in this country and in Canada and Britain, but it is still a problem in Mexico, Turkey, India, the Philippines, where they still have rheumatic fever. And since the penicillin and the wide use of penicillin, we don't see it as much in this country. What rheumatic fever and rheumatic heart disease does is it affects the heart valves within the heart, not necessarily the arteries. And if the heart valve damage goes unchecked, that can be catastrophic.
Got it. Skipping around here, but I'm going to go to one of my favorite topics in life, and that is coffee. Coffee. You know, I think I read a study every week that it's good, it's bad, one's okay, five's too much. Is there a definitive view on is coffee and caffeine okay for your heart?
I've seen those same studies. Now, when people come to see me because they have palpitations and we talk about their lifestyle and it turns out that they have a pot of coffee every morning and then they have the palpitations, that's probably the cause. So it really is a very individual thing. Some say coffee is good. Some say coffee is bad. It is very confusing. And that's part of the problem now is that studies get reported without much context. And so we really don't understand what went into that study. Was it six people at a coffee shop or was it 7,000 people? So we don't really know that all the time. And so I think if people are affected by caffeine, because caffeine does cause palpitations, and palpitations can be an arrhythmia, which is an abnormal rhythm of the heart. I've seen that. I've seen that from diet pills, energy pills, cocaine. All of those things can stimulate the heart and cause symptoms.
And I'm assuming energy drinks goes into that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
That's stuff you should stay away from.
Oh, yeah. I've seen arrhythmias. I've seen people who use them, and then they have arrhythmias, which are rapid, abnormal heart rhythms.
And does that cause damage on a long-term basis if you are taking in that kind of caffeine?
If you are drinking caffeine and you're having an arrhythmia or even just a fast heartbeat for months and months and months, yeah, it can affect your heart. It's rare, but it can.
Another topic near and dear to my heart is wine. Wine, you know, and I've read the good and the bad. One is okay, two is too much, women should not do anything. What is the common thought? Everything in moderation, you're going to tell me, right, Marla?
Right. Yeah. What you have to think about is there have been some studies that show that there may be beneficial qualities to wine, and they think it's through something called a phytoestrogen, which may be protective. It's probably in all grapes of all forms. You have to realize some of the research was sponsored by wine growers. So it's moderation. And when they talked about beneficial effects, they talked about 4 ounces. And for men, two drinks seem to be protective. Two glasses of wine seem to have a protective effect. But as you mentioned, for women, more than two drinks a day increases the risk of breast cancer. Uh-huh. And these phytoestrogens that are in the grape that we think are doing a good job, those have been associated with cystic breast changes in women. So a double-edged sword there.
Got it.
It is a lot of calories. It's a lot of sugar. But it's not prohibitive. It also can cause arrhythmias and fast heartbeats. But again, moderation.
So, but if it's between a martini and a glass of wine, you're probably better off with a glass of wine.
I don't have any science on martinis.
Okay. You can work on that, Dr. Mendelson. Now, what about red meat? And again, you know, I one of my questions is going to be, with all of this stuff online now, you're probably old enough to remember when we didn't have everything online and you couldn't get, you couldn't Google some symptoms and come up with 10 different diseases that you might have. I am in the same position with, as a lawyer. People Google and they come to me and tell me what the law is. And I'm like, well, that's Rhode Island law. That's not really Illinois. But there was a study about red meat saying that it may not be the fat in the meat that's bad for your heart, but it may be some bacteria that actually goes into your body that is a result of eating meat. Is red meat good, bad?
I don't think it's a good idea, personally. Okay. It leaves a very large carbon footprint. I've yet to hear anything beneficial about it. You can get protein through chicken, through fish, through turkey. Those are much more beneficial. In fact, fish is actually very beneficial because it has those good fats in it that are protective. There's nothing beneficial about meat,
okay,
that I know of, and I tend to discourage it.
Okay. And just really quick, and we have to go to a break, and I'm going to get your telephone numbers out. How do you find a good doctor? You're an excellent doctor. I know my husband Jerry thinks the world of you. He thinks women listen better. He likes the way you listen to him and listen to what he says and responds to it. And how do you find a good doctor? What's the best way to do that?
I think the best way is to start with a primary care doctor, because everyone needs to have a primary care doctor. And a lot of times the best way to find those doctors is through friends and personal recommendations, because there's lots of doctors out there, and it's really finding somebody that you are going to have a nice relationship with, that
right.
you are going to trust, that you are going to believe, that who you're going to believe has your best interest at heart. And then that doctor often recommends a specialist who they are comfortable working with, who they've seen in action, and I think that's the best way to go.
That's
really personal.
That's very, very good advice. If someone were to want to contact Dr. Marla Mendelson at Northwestern, how would we contact you?
The office is 312-695-4965.
Thank you so much for joining us. Will you join us again for maybe a health spot every month? How's that?
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Karen.
Coming up, the stories that matter from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Hello, welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. The trial of former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke was probably one of the most followed trials in Chicago history, probably the most followed trial in my lifetime. That, of course, is the police officer who shot and killed Laquan McDonald. And for the first time in half a century, on October 5th, a jury convicted him of murder, second-degree murder for that on-duty shooting. Jason Van Dyke's defense lawyer, Daniel Herbert. Welcome to the show. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Have you been able to sleep since then? It was funny. I was coming out of the Fox studio. I think it was either the day of the verdict or maybe the day after the verdict. And I took one look at you and you just look like a zombie. I mean, you were just so tired and so spent after all of that. It's quite a lot of work, and especially because it was so prominent and like. So, you know, I just want to talk a little bit about your background. You were a decorated Chicago police officer for about 10 years. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. And then you went on to prosecute with the state's attorney's office. And since then, you now represent police officers in criminal and civil matters and other first responders. Is that right?
Right. I mean, I'd say a pretty good portion of my business is police officers and firefighters, but I represent people from all walks of life.
Let's talk about the verdict. Just generally speaking, were you satisfied with the verdict? Do you think that it was a fair verdict?
No and no. I wasn't satisfied, and I don't think it was a fair verdict. We felt a sense of relief because the jury came back rather quickly. And we knew that that there were a lot of issues to hammer out, and that the quicker they came back, the less likely it was that we were going to receive a good verdict. But so when I say we were relieved when we found out it was second degree, and we found out that Jason was, you know, essentially was off his death sentence and would have a life to live after this incarceration. But to say that we were satisfied with the verdict, we were not.
Well, and as an attorney, as a trial attorney, as a litigator, you have a very strong sense of competition, and it's hard to lose at all in any way. And I think I said that to you coming out of the studio. I remember watching World Series years ago, and this is when Joe Garagiola, if you remember him, was announcing, and they were panning to the winners and panning to the losers, and he said, "Isn't it true that losing hurts worse than winning feels good?" And that's like one of the truest things I've ever heard, because when you lose something, and I'm not saying you lost, I think that you can make a very good argument that you had a very successful trial, but that stays with you forever. The win is something you brush off and you go to work the next day with a smile on your face, but a loss kind of stays with you for a while.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, Karen, as a trial lawyer, I mean, you really... you get so focused on the case, and you live it. And,
yes.
And you start... You know, you see the way the evidence is going in, and you start almost drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit. And I actually had a pretty refreshing conversation with a colleague of mine the day before I did closings. And I was telling him, I'm like, boy, the evidence is in so good. Do I even need to argue this first-degree murder? I don't see how they would consider it. And he looked me in the eye and said, I haven't seen much of the trial, but yes. He goes, there are at least half the people in there right now that are ready to convict for first-degree murder.
Let's talk about that strategy. And obviously, Monday morning quarterbacking is always easy. But as I see it, it was first-degree murder pretty much throughout this whole trial, and that was what was published, you know, that this was a very overcharged case. I mean, first-degree murder for a police officer is a very unusual charge. And at some point, the jury got the second-degree murder charge to consider. Was that the decision of the defense to give that to the jury?
It was. We included the second degree instruction, and we're happy we did.
Okay. And what was the strategy? First of all, can you just explain very briefly to our listeners the basic difference between first degree and second degree?
Sure. First degree murder is the intentional killing of somebody without justification, whereas second degree murder is first degree murder. However, there are mitigating circumstances which make it a second degree murder as opposed to a first degree. It's essentially an imperfect defense. Second degree.
So he believed that he needed to use that force, but was incorrect in his belief.
Right. He believed he needed to use it, but a reasonable officer in his situation would not have believed that. That's the difference.
So the strategy in giving the second degree, obviously, is that you're going to give the jury two options. If they don't want to convict of that first degree, which is a very difficult thing to prove, they have the option of the second degree. Now, had you not given them the second degree, that would have been rolling the dice, right?
Big time. Big time. It's
all or nothing.
Yeah, it's all or nothing. And, you know, in Illinois, the decision is almost easier because a lot of other states require that the prosecutor prove malice or prove premeditation, whereas in Illinois, it's relatively simple. You have to prove that he shot an individual with the intent to cause death or great bodily harm, and in fact, that individual died. So it's much more difficult from a defense standpoint in Illinois.
Having heard the jurors talk after the verdict, are you even more convinced that a second-degree murder charge was important for them to have?
Yeah. I never had any second thoughts about putting in a second-degree instruction. You know, quite frankly, I don't know what the jurors would have done, but I know that they were pressured to come up with a guilty verdict in this case. There's not a doubt in my mind that that there was a compromise in this case, and that second-degree murder was the accepted compromise. So, yeah, I think if we had not included that second-degree instruction, there may have been a compromise, or the people that were fighting for us may have just folded and went with the first-degree murder, which, of course, would have been a death sentence. It would have been
Absolutely.
45 years at 100%.
Absolutely. Let's go to the phones. We've got some calls here. Let's go to Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Do you have a question?
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
I wanted to ask your guest, attorney, what does it mean that the jury found Officer Van Dyke not guilty of official misconduct, but then they found him guilty of all this other second-degree murder and That doesn't add up to 100 to me. I just, something's wrong.
Okay, Jeff, that's a very, very good question and one that was on my list. I'm going to put you on hold, and Dan's going to answer that question.
Yeah, I agree. It's a very good question. It's an inconsistent verdict, and it supports my theory that there was nothing more than a compromise done by the jurors in this case, which would normally make me very angry. But I understand the juror's unique position here. The official misconduct is that Jason Van Dyke committed a criminal offense while acting in his official capacity. Found not guilty for that, however, found guilty for committing criminal offenses. So
that doesn't make any sense at all. Now, from a strategic standpoint, and we're going to get a little technical here because I'm a lawyer and we're in a legal show here, sort of. How do you make that argument to the judge? Is there an argument you can make to somehow mitigate something that that came down from the jury, saying the jury must not have understood or something? How do you make that argument?
Yeah, it's... You know, in civil cases, it's a lot easier. They have all those special verdict forms where it can essentially nullify a guilty verdict. In criminal court, it's a little bit different. But to your point, we can definitely use that as an argument. And we are going to ask the court to dismiss his verdict based upon the fact that it's not supported by the evidence that came into the trial. So that will certainly be part of our argument.
And all of those will be heard when? Is that the October 31st date that the court gave you?
Yeah, October 31st. We are going to be ready to file our motions and make all our arguments. And I'm not sure if the court is going to want to hear the arguments that day or continue it for a different day, but that will be done. All of that will be done prior to sentencing.
Okay. So just for people to understand the procedure here, there are these things called post-trial motions. And there are motions that some of them have already been brought, like the motion, and we'll talk a little bit about this, pretrial publicity. You move to have the case move to a different venue because you believe that pretrial publicity really stood in the way of him getting a fair trial. And so you'll rebring that motion again, right? That'll be something you'll bring again?
We will. Yeah, we're going to ask the court to obviously reconsider it in light of the evidence that has come to light since the voir dire process and since the verdict.
And just so you know, you'll throw everything in there. All the possible issues for appeal, you'll put into these motions. The judge will read them. The judge will decide them. Judges generally don't grant them. The judges could grant some of them. And then the case goes up on appeal.
Right, right. Assuming that the court denies our post-trial motions before the appellate court, then we have... We filed a lot of motions in this case, and we did it. They were all well-pled, and they were all based upon good faith. But I think we have some really, really strong appealable issues, and assuming that the verdict is not thrown out, we will certainly go forward on a number of those arguments to the appellate court.
And those are just very, very technical. They're not the sexy case. It's not like watching a trial or anything like that, but it's on technical issues that that's when you sit and you do your homework and you sit in the library and you pore over the cases and you try to cite to the judge something that's happened in the past that requires a reversal here. And that's when the brain surgery starts.
Yeah, and you know, we've really done a lot of the work here because we knew that this was a different case, and we knew that this was a case that, quite frankly, we were behind the eight ball the entire way. And so, you know, I'm proud at the moment. We must have filed over 20 motions about issues that warranted, in our belief, dismissing the indictment. So we have preserved every possible appeal right, and we have the arguments well underway.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We're talking to Dan Herbert, who was the criminal defense lawyer for Jason Van Dyke. The October 5th verdict came down. You probably all followed it. We're going to be talking to him some more into the next half hour. If you have any questions for him or comments, I would welcome them. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're back. It's Karen Conti here with Dan Herbert, criminal defense lawyer for Jason Van Dyke. If you have any questions for him about the trial, it's an interesting trial. You have some very interesting comments here. 981-7200. Let me go to an 847 text. My question is this. Do you feel that the judge was persuaded by the large amount of publicity not to change the venue and not to follow the use of force paradigm? This man is not guilty of any charge of murder. I feel like this decision from the jury was decided before hearing any of the evidence. The verdict scares every law enforcement officer out there. There's a bunch of questions in there.
Yeah, I wish he was on our jury.
That's right, really. Yep, so the publicity, I mean, let's talk about that. You ask the judge to move venue. It's not something that judges do very often. Is that fair to say?
Agreed.
I mean, the Speck case, I think, was one. Gacy was another.
Yeah.
Or Gacy, they brought in jurors from Rockford, I think.
Right. Gacy, they brought in jurors from Rockford. And, I mean, probably the most recent example where change of venue was denied was the Skilling case.
Yes.
And we actually cited to that quite a bit. We hired an exceptional firm to do this research, and we really put a lot of work into it. And, you know, and we had oral argument on it. We had live testimony on it. And at the end of it, I remember even the judge saying, wow, that Mr. Edelman is extremely impressive.
And he's
motion
he's,
denied.
Yeah, right. I mean, Edelman was, what is he, sort of like he does polls of people to see, you know, how many people saw the video, how many people already formed a conclusion. What were the stats on it, as you recall?
The stats were remarkable. And the difference was Brian Edelman, he does jury analysis for venue purposes. And the state, on the other hand, hired a company that does just general polling for a business to see what products people like. So we had a big distinction, and the numbers were, I believe it was 78% had prejudged Jason Van Dyke as guilty.
Wow.
Yeah, and depending on different areas of Cook County and different different races, it was up to 98% in the African American community in Cook County.
And but the judge has very broad discretion, right?
I
suppose his thoughts were, well, I can weed out those people on voir dire, and we don't need a jury that never heard of the case, only the ones that can say they'll be fair. And if they say they can be fair, they'll be fair.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the court said. And we gave so many arguments that you know, people are conditioned to give socially acceptable responses, and those conditions are even heightened and magnified when somebody is being asked that by a judge wearing a robe,
right,
and saying, well, are you telling me you can't be fair and impartial? And of course, these individuals that have had preconceived notions are saying, no, sure, judge, I can be fair and impartial. It's not an accurate way to determine whether or not somebody's fair and impartial. We had about 75 questions that would have elicited truthful responses, and the judge and the state objected, quite a bit, and it was clear that nobody really wanted to find out if these individuals could be fair and impartial. It was more along the lines of, let's make these people fair and impartial.
Well, and I watch jurors, judges all the time interview jurors, because jurors try to get out of jury duty. And they'll say, oh, I think I've made up my mind. Well, wait a minute there. You have an ethical obligation as a citizen of the United States to serve on a jury, and you can be fair, can't you? And it's almost like an indoctrination rather than a real questioning. And I don't know if this judge, I wasn't there for the jury selection, but I don't know how you get an honest answer from people.
Yeah, it's impossible, and that's why we wanted to have a very detailed questionnaire where people can answer these questions somewhat anonymously, and they won't be pressured. They can answer truthfully, because it's much easier to fill out a questionnaire and put your true feelings and beliefs down as opposed to sitting in a room. And in many instances, there was activists that were on the McDonald's side that were sitting in the room within feet of these potential jurors, and I mean, you could literally feel the tension in the room, and I felt bad for a lot of these potential jurors.
Well, and it's a lot to ask of a person. I mean, and I always think of this, you know, I'm a lawyer, you're a lawyer, we signed on for this job, right? We signed on to stand up and talk to people and to take on responsibility like this. But jurors don't do that. They want to live their lives. They don't want to decide people's fates. It's a huge imposition on them, and especially a case like this that's being watched nationally. And for some reason, I didn't buy the idea. Some of them said, "Yeah, I didn't really realize what a big profile this case had, and how could you not?" It was hard for me to believe that going into it, they didn't know that.
Well, especially the first day, they didn't know what case they were coming in for. But when they came in, they had to cross. They had to walk that gauntlet that you know from the parking structure at 26th California to get into the courtroom. And there was barricades set up that were holding literally hundreds of protesters with signs. Jason Van Dyke is a killer. Jason Van Dyke is a murderer. Convict Jason Van Dyke. So to say that those jurors had no impression by that phenomenon, it defies common sense. I mean, the barricades were there to protect the citizens from the protesters. So the message that it sends is, when you come back and you render your verdict, when you go home, these barricades will not be there. These police officers that are protecting you from these protesters, they will not be there. So certainly it had an effect on them.
I can't help but agree with you on that. We're talking to Dan Herbert, who represented Jason Van Dyke, police officer who was convicted of second-degree murder. Roger Battish, our news guy, has a question.
A couple, actually, if I may.
Sure.
I hope they'll be short and sweet and to the point. You say you're in the appeal process. How long do you think that's going to take? I mean, how involved is it?
Well, the appellate court, which we are not involved in that yet because we have to exhaust our motions in front of the court. But generally speaking, the appellate court is roughly 8 to 18 months, I think, has been the norm. This is a case that I would imagine there's going to be a lot of issues that will appeal, and we're going to focus on probably the three or four main issues that we think are our best arguments. So, yeah, I would imagine it'd be somewhere between a year and a year and a half.
And Jason will be out. He will not be in prison all that time. He will be able to be at home.
No.
He's been surrendered, and he has surrendered. He will be in prison during the entire time.
Yeah, assuming that the court denies our motion to dismiss the verdict, and assuming that the court denies our motion to have the verdict stayed until the appellate court rules, he will be in custody.
Okay. One other thing. I was watching the trial on TV, and when the verdict was read, I saw you, and I know I've already heard you say that you were happy that the judge said that they could consider second degree. But when the verdict was read, you kind of gasped a little, and you patted Jason's leg real quick. It was a quick motion. And some people that were commenting, I wasn't working at the time, but some of the news commentators said you had a stern look on your face, and I took it to be a look of relief. What was that moment?
Well, you took it the right way. A lot of people say I had a stern look on my face throughout this trial, and I probably did, but here, I had prepared Jason for some of the magic words that we were expecting to hear. And like I told Karen earlier, when the jury came back relatively early in the second day, and the first day was only a half day of deliberations, I was concerned. I was concerned that it was a first-degree murder verdict. So what I had told Jason, I said, listen, if we hear second-degree murder as a conviction, that is a relief. We know first degree murder is off the table. And at the time, you know, I sit back now, I'm not happy with the second degree. I'm certainly, relieved in a lot of senses. But at the time when I heard that second degree, when I tapped him, it was like, hey, you got your life back. And that's what we talked about, outside before we came into the courtroom, before the jury came back. I said, we're looking at a death sentence. I said, we need to get your life back. And so when I tapped him, it was basically, I was fairly relieved.
Yeah, that's. I saw that.
You saw that too?
I did. I absolutely saw
it was,
that.
And it was an instantaneous thing. And I said, "This, they don't look happy, but I'm thinking they're extremely relieved."
Well, and sometimes, you know, when you have a client, and you know, you know this better than I do, Dan, but you know, there's a relief that it's over. There's just a relief that now he can start doing what he needs to do. He's going to do his time. He's going to hopefully have an appeal. Maybe it'll be successful. Maybe he won't. But at least he can move on, and he knows what the worst is. You know, the worst is now established.
Right. Right. You know? And when you look at what the worst was here, you know, it was 45 years, 100%. That's it. He's done. He'll never see his family again. He'll never see his kids grow up. He'll never see him get married. He'll never see his, be able to hold his grandkids. So, when we looked at, when we were cognizant that this certainly might be on the table, despite how the evidence came in, because we firmly believe that there was no evidence to support that. Once we found out this is second degree only, we took a deep breath of relief.
One quick question, Karen, before you go to your break.
Okay.
It seemed, I noticed a lot of news people, and again, I wasn't working at the time. I work weekend overnights. But a lot of news people, as soon as the judge instructed the jury that they could consider second degree murder, a lot of the news people were kind of taken aback that that instruction was given. Was it something that we should have been taken aback by, or was it something we should have expected?
Well, if you follow criminal courts, then it's something that you definitely should have expected. I mean, for a defense attorney not to put in a second degree murder instruction, it's almost unheard of. It's borderline malpractice if you think about it. I know the jurors were, or I'm sorry, the media was certainly very inquisitive about that, asking whether we put it in, whether the state put it in, whether the court put it in. And the answer is that all three parties could have done that, us, the state, and the court, but we chose to put it in.
We're talking to Dan Herbert, criminal defense lawyer for Jason Van Dyke. If you have comments or questions, I know we've got some people on hold. We're going to get to you. 981-7200, 312-981-7200. On November 6th, you have the power to influence the course of politics by following the most comprehensive local political news online at chicagotribune.com/midterms. Hotel California. It's not like 26 in California. Not at all, right?
I don't know.
Not a nice place. Not a nice place.
It's a hotel for some.
I'll never forget Judge Beeble, who used to run the whole courthouse over there. I used to take my students there, and he said, look out over these buildings. There are 7,000 people here. It's the largest mental institution in the world.
Yeah.
Because so many people are, you know, very mentally ill who commit these crimes and are holding and waiting for their trials to happen. We've got a lot of good calls. I'm going to try to get to all of you. Thank you for holding. We've got Dan Herbert here talking about the Jason Van Dyke trial. Kathy, thank you for holding. Hi. What's your question?
Oh, hi. I was wondering why the attorney here is revealing his strategy when his work isn't entirely complete. And secondly, why did he have Jason Van Dyke and his wife both give interviews in the media when the judge told him not to?
Okay, great. I'm going to put you on hold. Thank you, Kathy. Go ahead. So you're telling your strategies even though your work's not done.
Yeah, well, the strategies here, this is, we've already laid all our cards on the table, and we've already identified all the issues that we believe are in error, and we believe that prevented my client from receiving a fair trial. So those issues are already out there, and we're just going to now identify which ones we will choose to go forward on.
Because all of those are a matter of public record. When you file a motion, it's all a matter of public record, and you may have to go to the courthouse to get it, but it's out there.
Right. There's no secrets. And, you know, we've talked many times and argued many times about our various motions. They've been in the media. So we're not revealing any strategy in any way.
Okay, as to the second question, at some point Fox ran some interviews with the with Jason Van Dyke himself and his wife. Tell us about the decision to do that, and apparently there was a gag order that this may have violated.
Yeah, there was a gag order in this case, and it referred to all the parties, certainly the attorneys, which we abided by. The gag order in no way held any weight over my client's wife, and her talking to the media was her right to do, and it's something that she chose to do. The McDonald family had daily, sometimes multiple times in a day, press conferences held at the courthouse. So as far as my client goes, my client wanted to do this, and it was not a direct violation of a gag order in any way. A gag order is meant to be on the attorneys. Individuals have a First Amendment right to speak, and my client's position at that point was he wasn't sure if he was ever going to see his kids again. This was right before the case went to trial, and he didn't know what was going to happen, and he wanted to speak out, tell a story which he had never ever told before. He wanted to do that not only to get his story out there, but also as a means of protection for his wife and kids, who have been threatened for the last 3 years on many levels.
And the judge didn't like the fact that he did that, though. Of course, the judge seems a little angry about a lot of things.
Well, Judge Gaughan's he likes to rule with an iron fist.
He does.
And you know, I've known Judge Gaughan for a while. We have a lot of mutual friends, and you know, I played sports with coaches that would yell and scream. It didn't bother me one bit. The only thing that bothered me was when I didn't think my client was receiving fair rulings or fair proceedings.
Let's go to Mike. Mike's been holding for a while. Hi, Mike. Welcome to WGN. You have a question for Dan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. I apologize if this has already been touched on, but I'm trying to understand the verdict. You have a second-degree murder, which typically is half the price or a quarter the price of first-degree murder. But you've got all these battery charges listed there, where you're hearing explanations where they have to run consecutive, minimum 6 years. You know, does this in effect put this person in jeopardy of a lifetime in jail? I certainly hope not, as it's definitely not murder one. And if all of these extra charges are on there, it seems like the murder two charge is perhaps posthumous. It was, you know, if he's getting all of the time of murder one, it is in a sense murder one, which really doesn't seem fitting. And I just wanted to add in there that a lot of people felt that, you know, this officer was thrown into the situation. He didn't wake up in the morning wanting that. It was far from premeditated. And I think if somebody's walking around town with a weapon incoherent and the police keep asking them to drop that weapon, that in and of itself is perhaps prosecutable. So this whole situation, you know, the person who died did a lot to stir the pot. So wouldn't want to see this person spend the rest of his life in jail. Probably, very possibly, has a price to pay. But I'm just trying to understand, does this, in effect, put him behind bars forever? Certainly okay. Hope not.
Mike,
and I appreciate
okay.
your time.
Thank you. We only have just a few seconds, but we're going to come back after the half an hour and take some more calls. So can you give a quick answer to that? That was a
yeah.
lot of commentary.
Yeah, there. No, it's a very good question. And, you know, some of the finest legal scholars, I've been reading some of their posts and some of theirs. There was an article that I just recently read that was in the Law Bulletin. And in this individual that wrote the article in the Law Bulletin commented on the fact that his analysis was that Jason Van Dyke would have to do a minimum of 96 years, based upon the aggravated battery counts. And he gave a good basis for his reasoning. Other people have said it's 12 years. Here's the thing. Jason Van Dyke should be given the minimum, no matter what it is. And certainly, if the minimum on first-degree murder is 45 years, and we're talking about getting a sentence that's higher than that for something that's lesser, that is preposterous. It's our belief that he should get a maximum of six years, and we believe that it should be at 50%, and that's what we're going to argue.
Okay, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. We've got to take a break. You're listening to WGN. I'm here with Dan Herbert, who is the criminal defense lawyer for Jason Van Dyke. Give us a call, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. Okay, we're still talking about the Jason Van Dyke trial. There's a lot to talk about. We've got some great callers and great texts. We're here with Dan Herbert, who represented Jason Van Dyke. Let's talk a little bit about, I think this got lost in the shuffle a little bit, because I try to comment on this when I do my commentary. What does a police officer get to do and when? What kind of force does a police officer get to use on the job? I think this is something that everyone needs to understand, and this would maybe put this whole verdict in perspective.
Yeah, and that was a big part of our argument. There was a law that was put in the books in the early 1960s. It's called the Peace Officer Use of Force Statute. And to just break it down, police are allowed to use deadly force in essentially two separate situations. One is a defense of life, either theirs or somebody else, which is what everyone recognizes as self-defense, and which is what the prosecutors argued in this case. And they didn't focus at all on the other area, which is you can use deadly force in certain fleeing felon arrestee situations. And that whole second set was ignored by the prosecutors. It was ignored by the judge when we asked to dismiss it, and it was ignored by the jurors, because the fact of the matter is police can use deadly force against a fleeing, forcible felon when that person threatens or inflicts great bodily harm to another person. We had that in this situation. They can use deadly force against a fleeing felon when they're using a deadly weapon to aid their escape. We had that in this case. Laquan McDonald flicked out the knife, but for the knife, he would have been arrested. Or the fleeing felon will somehow endanger human life if not captured immediately. We had that. He threatened to kill this poor truck driver. So the fact that, you know, we raised this in pretrial, we're like, here, nobody has addressed these issues. A police officer can use deadly force in these situations, and the prosecutors have only focused on saying he didn't have an imminent fear of death to himself, being Jason Van Dyke. And I mentioned they cannot argue the other prong of it, these other fleeing felon factors. It was ignored by the prosecutors, it was ignored by the judge, and the jurors didn't even contemplate it, even though there was a jury instruction to that effect.
And I guess what I heard over and over again was the prosecutor saying, you know, he defending himself, and that's one thing, but if you're a peace officer, you're not just out there defending yourself, you're defending others. And the law, whether you like it or not, I mean, and I said this a million times, and people were looking at me like, well, whose side are you on? Well, I'm just telling you what the law is. The law is, he commits a felony, he is a danger, he's got a knife, which is a deadly weapon, there are people that might be impacted in a crowded restaurant, he's already lunged at someone, he's slit a police tire, he's not stopping when he's being told 50 times to stop, and all of those things together, the law allows Jason Van Dyke to take out a gun and shoot him. I mean, whether you like that or not, that's the law.
Right. And the law, it really has to be torn up. It has to be rescinded, because it has absolutely no teeth. The defense of life policy, that's something that a police officer enjoys, but so does every other citizen. Every other citizen can defend themselves or defend somebody else from death or great bodily harm. What the peace officer use of force statute, the other prong of that, the fleeing arrestee, that is the prong that is designed for police officers who have no duty to retreat, who have a duty to enforce the law. So those factors they have to be looked at. Otherwise, we are turning police officers into no different than just another regular citizen.
Absolutely. And even when you heard the jurors talk about, there was a point in time where Jason Van Dyke testified that he thought he was backing up. And maybe that wasn't the case, but that's how his recollection was. And I'm thinking, you don't have a duty to back up if you're a police officer. You have a duty to get out and stop people. You know, so that's different than what we should do. I mean, yes, we pull up in a car and there's someone with a knife. We can stay in the car because that's who we are. We can stay in the car and watch someone with a knife. When you're a police officer, your job is to get that person and make sure that person doesn't hurt anyone. So I just think that the jurors, I'm not sure they understood that. From what they said after the trial, I'm not sure they understood. Did you get the same feeling that they didn't really get that?
Yeah, I do, Karen. I think that they looked at it as what would we have done as reasonable citizens in that situation. And that's, you know, another big part of our argument is that we asked for jury instructions that spoke to the reasonable nature of a police officer in the same situation that Jason Van Dyke was in. And we were essentially denied jury instructions that focused on the reasonableness of police officers' actions, even though that it was an accurate statement of the law.
Interesting. And Edward has a text and says, this is something that a lot of texters and phone people are saying. A serious concern, members of the jury stated that acquittal was never considered as an option. How do you take that statement, Dan? How do you take the statement that the jurors said that?
I take it as fact and proof of the matter that this case should never have been tried in Cook County. Of course, these jurors would not have considered acquittal, because then they would be forced to go home to their neighborhoods without protection of barricades and police officers, and they would be identified by the media, which they were. They were identified by them, not by name, but anyone that knew those jurors, there was an article written about every one of them the day after, identifying certain demographics about the jurors. So a couple of them mentioned, everyone knew that I was juror number 248. So to answer your question, yeah, acquittal was never on the table because my client never once enjoyed the presumption of innocence in this case. He had the burden of guilt. And we had to go through a lot of work and toil and labor to prove my client innocent of first-degree murder. And of course, as you know, that's not what we are required to do here.
And of course, I'm going to hear the other side here of the 708 texter. No right to shoot someone 16 times. Guilty. And that's what you hear on the street, and that's what I heard all the time. And again, had this case been one where Jason Van Dyke took out his gun and shot twice, would we be here? Would this be a case that we were all following and caused demonstrators to line the streets? Would it have been? And why 16 times? And why? How do you, as a lawyer, how do you justify that was correct action, that was something that was not a crime?
Well, the first thing to recognize is that my client wasn't charged with excessive force. If my client was charged with shooting too many times, that would have been an excessive force case in federal court. The federal government had this case for over a year. They looked at it, and they certainly weren't clear on whether or not charges were appropriate. How do I answer it with respect to first-degree murder? The number of shots essentially is immaterial to the charge of first-degree murder. Is 16 shots a lot? Absolutely. But I think that the way that the evidence went in, you know, a lot of police officers wouldn't have shot 16 times. A lot of police officers wouldn't have gotten out of the vehicle. The fact of the matter is he got out. He viewed a threat that may have been exaggerated in his mind. And when I say that, certainly when Mr. McDonald was on the ground and there were subsequent shots that were fired, you know, when I first saw that, you know, I had questions about not only the number of shots, but certainly the last volley of shots. And when my client explained it to me, and, you know, it didn't necessarily match up with what I was seeing on the video, but his explanation was an explanation that an officer would reasonably have in that situation. And that's just not my opinion. We backed it up with scientific testimony that was unrebutted, but equally as troubling, it was not even considered by the jurors.
When a police officer takes out his gun and uses deadly force, a gun is deadly force, he doesn't shoot for the arm or the leg, like in the movies where you want to just maim someone, correct? Even as a handgun user, you are trained to shoot center mass because, first of all, you don't want to miss, and if you're nervous, you could miss an arm or a leg. And if you've decided to use deadly force, you use deadly force. I mean, there's no in-between, right?
Right. And you know, something that really has never come out, it certainly didn't come out of the trial, but Jason Van Dyke was not a good shooter. He had remedial classes in the training academy. And certainly his shots were pretty effective that night as far as hitting his target, but it goes towards, you know, Jason Van Dyke had no idea if he even hit Laquan McDonald because he certainly didn't see the bullets going into his body. But yeah, when police officers are trained to shoot, they have no intent to kill. It's the intent to eliminate the threat, and they are taught to shoot center mass, and in certain situations, it's center mass and then one shot to the head in case the individual is wearing body armor. And again, they're taught to fire as many times as they can, as fast as they can, until that threat is eliminated.
And to reload.
And the testimony at the trial was Jason Van Dyke, it took a second and a half, 1.6 seconds from the time he started shooting for Laquan McDonald to fall to the ground. Jason Van Dyke fired 9 shots in that time period, and that's what a reasonable police officer could fire in that time period. And then there's a second and a half lag time from when the eyes recognize that an individual is on the ground. The eyes give that to the brain, and then the brain tells you to stop shooting. So that was another second and a half. And again, this was from the state's evidence. So at that point, Jason Van Dyke would have been justified in firing 18 rounds at that 3-second period. And of course, he didn't fire 18 rounds. He fired 14 or 13 or 14, and then a final 2 or 3.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We're here with Dan Herbert. We're still going to be taking some of your calls in the last 15 minutes about the Jason Van Dyke case. It's the flu shot season this Monday morning at 6:40 a.m. on the Steve Cochran Show. Dr. Kevin Most will be in studio administering flu shots to the show members, regardless if they are scared of needles. Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. Now, I didn't take legal calls in this show, and if you have legal calls, if you have questions for me, I usually take them the last hour, but we kind of got caught up here with the Jason Van Dyke case and some of the interesting things here. But I'm available at my office. You can call me at 312-332-7800. I'll try to answer your question or refer you in the right direction. You can also email me. That's probably the better way. You can tell me what your issue is, what your problem is, what you're looking for, maybe what county you're in, and I can send you in the right direction. That email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com, K-A-R-E-N-C-O-N-T-I, wgn@askkarenconti.com. Dan Herbert represented Jason Van Dyke, is continuing to represent Jason Van Dyke, post-trial motions coming up October 31st, and then sentencing. I've got a bunch of final questions here. The decision to testify, obviously criminal defendant doesn't have to testify, but that jury wants to hear him, don't they? Was that a good decision to have him testify? The jurors said they didn't buy it. They didn't buy his testimony. They thought he was rehearsed. What do you make of that?
Well, Karen, as you know, that's a decision that truly has to be made by the client. And my client, he wanted to testify. I advised him that it was important for him to testify in a self-defense case. I think it's something that he needed to do. You know, I ran it past a lot of my colleagues too, and I will say that every single person I spoke to told me the same thing. So, you know, here, the jurors that didn't buy Jason Van Dyke, that's for whatever reason they had in their hearts and their guts and in their minds. It wasn't because of anything that Jason Van Dyke said or was impeached on. That simply was that was their opinion, or that was a way to justify the decision that they had already made.
I didn't think he did such a terrible job. I mean, a lot of people were saying that he did a bad job. I mean, he's not, you know, he's not an orator. He's not, he doesn't do this for a living. And even though he's a police officer and police are trained to testify, but they're trained to testify in traffic stops against other people, not themselves. So it's a whole different skill set. I do think, though, that what was interesting about his testimony was he recalled the events differently than the video portrayed. And I think I took that as his memory was just not exactly the way it happened because of the stress of what he did. As he said, he was backing up. He wasn't backing up. But he said, that's how I remembered it. And I think a lot of people took that maybe to say that he was being dishonest or deceptive, when in fact, I think he was just remembering it the way he remembered it.
Yeah, and that Jason's testimony came right in the heels of Dr. Lawrence Miller, who gave some pretty, what I felt was compelling evidence that was unrebutted and not impeached in any way, shape, or form. But that was that police officers involved in these situations, they don't remember certain aspects of it, and that's just science at work. It's the body's defense system. They have tunnel vision, they have auditory exclusion, they have focal vision, where they are looking at nothing wider than your thumb as you're holding your arm extended. That's how narrow their vision becomes. So yeah, here, Jason, he is not a snake charmer. He is not somebody that can go up and wow people, and that is not a knock on Jason. That is who he is. When he went up there and testified, he was he truly was speaking from his heart. And as far as him being overly rehearsed, I mean, I will admit that I prepared a cross for him that took 11 hours the night before, and it was very, very heated, and it was much more difficult than any cross that he experienced a couple days later when he was testifying in front of the state. His direct examination, what he said on direct, that's Jason Van Dyke. He is he thinks about his answers. And he is not looking to charm anyone. He's simply answering the questions as best as he can and as honestly as he can. And we have no regrets about putting him on.
I don't know that it moved the dial one way or the other. Do you think, do you feel like, I mean, if he had not testified, I feel like the jury would have said, well, where was he? I mean, who best to say why I did what I did than Jason Van Dyke? Why didn't he testify? I kind of feel they would have done that.
I agree with you 100%. I mean, I think that anyone that that made a comment that Jason Van Dyke wasn't believable and that contributed in one way or another to their verdict, had he not testified, they would have been using that lack of testimony to justify their verdict. It again goes back to this verdict was nothing more than a compromise, and it was something that was predetermined.
630 texter says, did he ever drop the knife? I thought he testified that he never dropped the knife. Would a PCP addict feel any pain? Why did you not describe that a stun gun would not work on a PCP addict?
He never dropped the knife. He held on to it until it was kicked out of his hand. As far as a stun gun on a PCP addict, nobody can definitively say that it would not have worked. Nobody could definitively say that it would have worked. But the fact of the matter was, there was no stun gun on the scene. And the prosecutors made a big deal about a car arriving moments later with a stun gun. Well, what they didn't tell the jury and what we argued that shouldn't have been allowed in is that that car never came over the air to say that they had a taser and they were pulling up on the scene. So it's a completely irrelevant point that the prosecutors made very relevant because they didn't have any real evidence to focus on. But it was enough for the jurors, who had essentially already made up their mind.
The consent decree has come down and been agreed to by the Chicago Police Department, I believe the Attorney General's office, and now it's going to have a federal monitor, and there's some provisions in there that police officers are now going to be required to document when they pull out their gun to use it. Tell me how what the morale of the police department is. I mean, you represent a lot of policemen. You were a policeman. You're close to them. You hear the beat of it. What's going on with Chicago Police Force right now after this verdict and with that consent decree?
Well, in some areas, there's a lot of anger that they feel like they're not being allowed to do their jobs. And unfortunately, in some areas, police officers are like, okay, you made my job much easier. My job is to get in a squad car, and the most thing I'm going to do is back out of the station parking lot and drive around for a little bit. You know, I don't know if that's what the public wants. You know, police officers are great rule followers. Give them rules and they will follow them. If they don't want the police to do proactive policing, well, then make that part of the statute. And I assure you, they won't do it. They're doing it because they feel like it's part of their job, and they feel like a sense of accomplishment doing it. But if the people that they are doing it for don't feel that it's necessary, then believe me, they will back off. And unfortunately, that may happen. The consent decree, you know, the Justice Department pointed out some really good points. There was some excellent points made as far as making them document every time you pull your gun out. I mean, I was a policeman. I very rarely went a shift without pulling my gun out. It's going to be pretty laborsome.
Dan Herbert, thank you so much for joining us. You stayed a lot longer than I told you you were going to stay. But I appreciate it, and we had a lot of really good questions, and I think it's a great thing to be able to explain what happened and have a little bit more detail. But thank you so much for joining us. If someone wanted to contact you, how would they contact you?
Sure. My office number is 312-655-7660, and my website is danherbertlaw.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, everyone, for listening. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN.